The good news is everybody was happily engaged talking to each other, and that to me is a sign of real bonding, as Judy Grimes said on the commission. The bad news is we're late, so I apologize for that. But instead of reading you the hearing room exit sign whole thing again, please let me just point out, you know, like on the plane, there are two of them, and make sure that, you know where one of them is. Occasionally things do happen like that. So, okay. All right. So,
you got to say congratulations to the Huskies and good luck with
your game. You're right. Okay. So how many people watched the game? Yeah, I did until I didn't get the whole game. I mean, what an exciting thing. So mazel tov, as they say in my culture, to the Huskies and for the men, but we know the women will repeat. Right?
Kentucky may have a great strategic plan for higher education, but we beat them. You know?
Oh, my goodness. Sally, would you do me a favor? Turn the mic on and say that out loud. People need to hear this.
Shabazz is carrying the flag for graduation for the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences, and his GPA is 3.6. So not only is he a fabulous individual and great basketball player, but he's an excellent academic player.
And he will graduate, as a graduate of
his
a big school that doesn't do that.
Yes, mother insisted, and when a lot of other people bailed when we lost academic eligibility, he stayed. So if you heard him last night, that was his kind of, and that had nothing to do with this particular team either. So, yeah, we're very proud of him.
Yes. John, put your mic on, please. And then we're going to get to business, I promise.
Okay. Fox News, according to my wife, really hammered him for saying something about being the team not being allowed to play in the NCAA. I mean, they totally missed the point.
Yeah, that it wasn't this team.
I know. We were all going to be in pretty sad shape today. But. So in any case.
The girls are tonight.
Yes, at 7:30, I believe.
8:30.
Oh, but who's counting?
And the girls are really smart.
Yes, very. They all have that average.
Exactly. Well, and that's what we should be struggling for at all colleges and universities. Athletes should be scholars and athletes as opposed to just one or the other. So let me do some welcome backs. We have some good news. John Bennett has returned to public. Being here in person, having rallied, and we have Dennis, who has joined us as well, too. So I really am glad to have you guys back. It's really wonderful. So let's move, and because we have some interesting conversations to have, and I'm looking forward to that as well, too. We do have minutes to approve. I would love to entertain a motion. Thank you, Lindy. In a second. Okay, thank you. All those in favor? Those opposed? Abstentions? Yeah, two abstentions, all right. Terrific, so we've done that. So hopefully all of you have had a chance to look at the materials that went out last week because today we're going to dive, and I think it's going to be a wonderful discussion. So we will start with the goals section, and let me turn this to Dennis, and again, welcome back. We know you were there, but it's nice to see your face.
acceptance, not just any 12 credits, and turn them into a certificate. And yeah.
The 70% is 50% bachelor's and 20% associate's degrees, and that 30% certificates is embedded in both those other factors. I'm trying to figure out how the numbers don't end up, and I'm trying to figure out where you're incorporating what, whether the associate degrees are separate, certificates are separate.
Since these are your numbers,
I think that we have some confidence.
Let
me give you the reality. If you listen to people about certificates, it is a reality that a fair number of those certificates also are awarded to people who have either associate degrees or bachelor's degrees. So it, in some ways, I don't know that you'll add up. I think that Dennis will.
Well, I think that what we're really saying is that 50% probably need baccalaureate degrees in your economy. That will be consistent.
That's a screen above, yeah.
Yeah. Baccalaureate above. I mean, that's pretty consistent with where you've been historically. The other 20% is really associate degree and certificates.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
See, I read that it took the 50, 20, and 30. And that was 100%, so that meant there were 35% with baccalaureate, 14% with associates, and 21% with.
If we look around the country, the state with the highest level of associate degrees has about 15%, so your 14% jump would be about that. And I think in this economy, everybody is, the state that probably has made this most explicit is Oregon, where they're saying 80% of their adult population have post-high school education, 40% with baccalaureate, the other 40% with associate or certificate, and then that latter category they've broken down into 15 and 25. So,
whatever we do, this one needs to be reworded to be clearer so you know what we're talking about.
It would also make sense to put some, to where it should increase to 70% from the current da-da-da-da-da-da or whatever.
Yeah. We can do that.
Judy has a question.
It's not really a question. I think we're just reading it. It's maybe two sentences. 70% need degrees.
Right.
And the way they should break down are 50 with bachelor's, 20 with associates, and 30 with certificates. I think that's so
right.
Just two sentences.
That's what John was basically saying.
Right.
That's a better interpretation. We'll make that more explicit. Second goal is to, and by the way, underlying that are some sub-goals that talk about closing the attainment gap between whites and underrepresented minorities, closing the gaps between urban or inner cities and other cities, and increasing the numbers of adults that get some kind of credential. We went through that model and I think demonstrated that Connecticut cannot get to that 70% number if you give 18-year-olds absolutely best in the country and getting them out of high school into college and through college. That number doesn't get you to 70%. which means that Connecticut's going to have to pay much more attention to adults than it historically has. So underneath this bill are some other disparities that are important if you're going to get there. The second piece is, it's kind of got two pieces to it. One of them is to not only have degrees, but to have those degrees aligned with the workforce needs of the state. And also, particularly for the research university, to have that research activity translated into an expanded economy, commercialization of that research. So, on the one hand, there is an explicit statement that says develop a globally competitive economy. But the second piece is it's more than just higher education as an economic driver. It's higher education as an important contributor to a sustainable economy, or sustainable community, I'm sorry. And by that, you know, it's not only economy, but it's environment, it's culture, it's those other things that keep people wanting to live here. And when you look and talk to employers, one of the things that we keep hearing is, you know, the difficulty of keeping people here. It's a high cost state, there's been individuals to live in. And so what the amenities are for college graduates employed in the state, important part of the consideration of what our education contributes.
Lindy?
One of the things that familiarity, it's not always good. You sort of have to, these goals, that second goal is really good. And I think we're pretty good at tech transfer. The problem is that on the same set of goals, you have to develop the venture capital community because the tech companies go where the money comes from. And that's a major issue.
I don't know how many got a chance to see the email which I strategically sent after most of you were on the road. But I honestly think with respect to the first two goals, I like them both in general. I think the first goal somehow needs to have some wording in it with regard to the worthiness of the degrees as well as the numbers, okay? Because that's the only way we're going to be able to meet our legislative charge. And the second one, I think, it goes along, Dennis, with what you were saying a few minutes ago. And what I talked about it is I love the word culture in there. It's already there, but I expanded that a little bit in my email, and I called it the culture of responsibility and opportunity. And I think that gets a lot of the kinds of things that you are, whether you're talking about the cost of living, whether you're talking about the kind of places we have. But we have to have we have to help do our part to work toward getting people to want to stay in Connecticut or come to Connecticut if we're going to meet the first goal especially, keep them.
That was a major theme. One of the issues I've raised is how you measure that. And I just want to give you another example. I hope I don't, for some audiences, it would be extreme, but I've spent a lot of time on the future of Ireland. And if you look at the national strategy of Ireland, they have an explicit goal related exactly to this. Because for reasons that are more extreme, the real trick is not only creating a new economy, but a place where people want to live, but particularly to attract and retain highly educated people from throughout Europe and the world. They have measures in their accountability which, in fact, directly relate to institutions accountable for, in fact, their community engagement. And ironically, they draw on indicators that come from the Carnegie Foundation for Teaching, you know, and Learning from the U.S. This is not something that is so abstract, but you really got to, we heard the feedback in every employer group. They, particularly at the baccalaureate and above level, they cannot retain people, partly it's cost of living, but also because of a set of variables that relate to arts, culture, and the other kinds of things that are happening. And if you look at the higher ed institutions, both public and independent, these are the incredibly rich resources in this state. So the question is, are there deliberate incentives? And this has to be engage everything related to faculty reward systems, engagement of students through internships and service, curriculum that, in fact, gives opportunities for students to be involved, engagement of students in essentially urban agriculture, a whole set of other things like that, that will really make this an attractive state. So it isn't an abstract issue. It's something that really, you know, we heard feedback on throughout. I happen to feel strongly about that. It's hardly a commercial, but these kinds of phrases could go by without connecting it to the realities of the future of the state. That's kind of...
I understand what you're saying, and I totally agree. But when I look at that goal, I don't see how it relates to our committee because of the way it's phrased. So maybe it could be rephrased that talks about the responsibility of education or the educational system to create that kind of environment which supports the overall circle that you're talking about.
But isn't that the theme of the whole thing? It's really how higher ed contributes to education attainment. Yeah,
And if I look at that, it doesn't say to me, why would that come out of a higher education planning committee? Or it's too global to be something that we can effectively do anything about. And if you focus it on based on what you're actually talking about, then it makes a lot of sense because it relates to the our audience or our group of people we're trying to plan for.
You know, frankly, in every conversation in every state, somebody says, oh, well, really higher ed can't do much about that. And frankly, that's given the number one excuse not to do something. So if you see you see my visceral reaction realize that there are more institutions sitting in urban areas that are nonprofit institutions, okay, they're exempt from taxation in communities that are desperately poor. So if those institutions are not engaged in essentially creating communities, they're in fact contributing to their demise because there are no resources to support them. So that's my passion.
But you just said something. You said engage.
I'm sorry, you're being
engaged. No. I want to take what you said and try and incorporate that into the thing. It's not about the global competitive environment. It's about engaging the institutions of higher education to create this environment, maybe, or something like that.
Contribute to.
Right.
I think John was next. John Shimu? Okay, and then Judy Goldfarb, and then let's come back to John.
This morning there was a governor's symposium on aligning birth to age 8. So across public school systems, there were superintendents, principals, teachers, et cetera. And when the governor spoke, he spoke about not providing opportunities but providing success. And so when you measure, how do you measure opportunity versus how do you measure success, I think that we really want people to be successful in attaining a degree, a certificate, a quality of life. And so I liked his idea of success.
You know what, why don't you finish this? Because my comment kind of covers this whole scheme of goals. So I'll let you finish before we got back.
The last one. Let me back up. On the economic and competitive economy, one of the things that we've heard a lot is, one, there aren't a set of industries or kinds of jobs that are high priority for the state. And so a contribution to higher education for folks with those degrees are particularly important. Healthcare,
STEM, but it also goes into manufacturing and advanced manufacturing and some things at the two-year level. And when we listen in the regional meetings to employers, which we put a lot of, there is feedback that says, and it's not just about giving them classroom instruction, but it's also giving them work experience. Okay, so don't just think that you can do this in a classroom or a laboratory, particularly in the associate certificate level. They need the experience of what is possible to work when you're working in a field like this. And, you know, we're going to come back in multiple ways because I think that there are ways that links to the affordability issue as well. What form the student financial aid takes, for example, that leads to that kind of experience. And the final big goal up there is affordability. You know, when we look at students that have to be brought into the system and made successful in that system, they are overwhelming, low income, first generation, probably not really well academically prepared for college. You know, if you were to give them the AccuPlacer or readiness test, a high proportion of them would test in some, probably the lowest level of developmental education. And so, how does one make sure that those kinds of students don't get quite out of their capacity to get college education? And that is maybe, you know, when we take a look at, to put a measure to it, it's probably what's the cost of attendance relative to the family income or the low income that people in the state, not the average. I just did this little exercise for Illinois. Their average, you know, their affordability for the median family income is very good, but the national average, you do it for the low income income, just off. I mean, it takes 80%+ of a family's income to go to a two-year institution. And that's after grant aid, including the state grant program. So, you really have to think seriously about how much it costs and what the mechanisms are for low-income students to pay to help you achieve the goals that you have set out there. But you can't get the 70% new ratio of reform without getting lots of those kinds of students into the system. So that's the kind of goals that we're talking about.
I wonder if a fourth goal shouldn't be shouldn't be added to this page, and that is outcomes assessment. How do we assess? Suppose we increase educational attainment, develop globally competitive, et cetera, and we do all those things. You've got to have a way to measure your success and then close the loop on the basis of your assessment, so we really should be able to establish some kind of way to assess outcomes and gauge our success as part of the goal, not as an afterthought.
One of the things that you will do, in fact, have done, is, in fact, lay out a set of metrics that associate with these things that look like the outcome measures. So we hear you, but I think what we would recommend is we just make the measures a part of each, you know, associated with each goal set of measures that say, you know, here's how we're going to know whether we're making progress on these goals or not. So that, but there will be necessarily quantitative ways to track progress and monitor. That would be our recommendation rather than making it independent goals.
But would that be a policy recommendation that we will assess it on an annual basis as opposed to just building it into a general something?
And a report to the public on
that. Yeah, I mean,
you will, in her amount, to talk, now talk about policy.
Okay.
And
states that you know of use these metrics so we can see not only if we've moved our own meter at all, but how compared to other states at the same point in time we're doing?
38 or so have formal goals, but as far as the metrics that we would propose about how you keep as far as the metrics that we would propose, how you keep score on these, most of them are metrics that we can get all 50 state data for, so we would be able to show how all states are moving on these kind of metrics. So, for example, again, we did a project like this for Illinois 5 years ago, and last week I reported back to them about what's happened in the last 5 years. And so they've made progress, but they've made less progress than many of the other states. And, in fact, the white minority attainment gap has gotten bigger, not smaller, over the last 5 years. And that's true for almost all states. There's a very small handful where that's not true. So lots of these kind of things that we've talked about, we can get data put you in a 50 state context. Okay? Is that
one fixation that
Yeah, the one metric that is hardest to come by, Sally, is the one about business activity resulting from research. That one is harder to get data from other institutions and states. I mean, you've got something that you track, but that is not a universal.
There's a new term that's emerging called cylinders of excellence, as opposed to talking about operating in silos, because silos seem to have more of a negative impact than cylinders of excellence. I don't see a strong enough piece about coalition building and continuity. I know that you have engaged higher education institutions and regional strategies to develop sustainable communities, but I'm not sure that that's strong enough in terms of the partnerships that have to exist among universities and partnerships that have to exist with business in order to make this viable.
Ames, before you do that, my manners are showing. May I interrupt for a second? I am aghast that we have not introduced our newest leadership at the Board of Regents, and we have a new provost to welcome to both the work that we're doing here at the Commission and to Connecticut. I know, but I thought it might be nice, since we didn't do the go-around and who everybody is, and to give you a chance to introduce yourself and then let everybody tell you who's sitting at the table and what they represent. My apologies.
Thank you, and I am Mike Argano. I've recently joined the Connecticut State College and University System as the provost and senior vice president for academic and student affairs. I know the two gentlemen that are here today extremely well because we've done an awful lot of work together in Louisiana on many, many issues. And I arrive, by the way, of Texas. And I was born here in Connecticut, so I've returned to Connecticut. So part of what you're actually talking about earlier is that how do we bring back our citizens, right? And so this is such an important endeavor. And I can share with you, having been through this in two other states, that while it is painful to get started, once you do get started and you take that leap of faith, the rewards are enormous for the state. There's probably not a state in this union quite like Louisiana that has the poverty that may be beyond Mississippi and Alabama. But I can share with you that we went through this various exercise in great depth and quite a bit of ajna. But years later, the number of the citizens of Louisiana that have an advanced degree has increased exponentially. And that economy has changed dramatically to extend far beyond just the oil industry that it's well known for, because of the advancements that were made in education attainment at all different levels. So I'm happy to be here and looking forward to working with you, but just wanted to point to you guys.
Sorry to put you on the spot. Can we just do a quick go-around so that Mike can know who everybody is, for those that he doesn't yet know, in what agency you're from or what organization you're from?
Hi, good afternoon. I'm Carrie Kelly. I'm with the Office of Policy and Management.
Yeah, good afternoon. My name is Ted Yonkelis. I'm the Principal Academic Affairs Officer for the Board of Regents of Higher Education.
I'm Judy Graham, and I run the Connecticut Conference of Independent Colleges.
Hi, Ainsley Diamond from the Board of Regents.
Sally Reese, Vice Provost for Academic Affairs at the University of Connecticut.
Lindy Gold, Department of Economic and Community Development.
Dennis Jones, NCHEMS.
Douglas Hajimichael, faculty and recent dean of the School of Engineering at Fairfield University.
John Bennett, emeritus faculty at the University of Connecticut.
Lois Schneider, management consultant.
John Shima with the Metro Hartford Alliance.
Greetings, I'm Dennis Murphy, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Labor.
Hi, I'm Judy Goldfarb, and I'm the appointee of the Governor's Office to this committee and a special focus on early childhood.
Ames. One thing I also want to say here is that these are the policy tools available at the state level. And what we are really saying by these is that at the state level, you can't run institutions. And that what we're, you know, that these are policy tools that can be pulled at the state level. There's a whole bunch of other things that has to happen for this, these goals to be achieved that have to happen at the system and campus levels. And we're taking special pains to try to separate those so that, you know, that these are separate from what you do at UConn and what you do at the state college university system. So just...
Because right now,
are in fact moving to what the questions are about metrics. You can do that for one of the sections will be doing that, but you need something that talks about how everything for all the sectors seems to be going backwards. Your point about measurement. To do the annual reporting, provide a venue for discussing challenges in a way that is not in fact checked by the agenda of any particular party, which is a key part of it. And the second change relates to sort of characteristics that are really important to this tonight. These things have to be really put together by the most influential leaders in the state. I would say one of the challenges is numbers they have is that on down the page, you were more talking about this, so about Kentucky. If you look at Kentucky, the number of corporate headquarters in Kentucky has gone from many to almost one, two, or three. There are, in fact, it's very hard in Kentucky to find statewide leaders and state leaders. But if the three of the business and state leaders who really led to a major reform effort in the United States, and in fact, they were the only ones who stand out. Independence is absolutely essential, but it's also not only independence, but trusting relationships with political leadership as well as with the higher education leadership. These are not entities that are pitted against others, but they value and speak independently on issues, people, and others. And then not encumbered by responsibilities for governing something or for regulatory administrative functions. I happen to specialize in issues related to governance and multi-manager systems. So one of the challenges for even, say, the State University of New York is that students have a major responsibility, but the day-to-day agenda, and I think if you look at the agenda of the Board of Regents, the responsibility of governing institutions requires committee structures and other things that actually carry out some really important functions. It's very different from carrying out these kinds of roles. Now, our sense is unless Connecticut has these kinds of capacities, then you will go nowhere. It's almost that blunt. And I think that is really important. We've got to have this capacity. And if you don't, it will disintegrate into a discussion mainly about tourism, about objectives, about institutional priorities. There will really be no connection to the kind of role we're talking about. Now, this commission can lay out these agendas and mandates for the annual report, but it's out of the assumption that, you know, like who. And we don't have an instant answer, but I just want to just put it out on the table as an observation about the answer. I'm going to turn to Dan so we can talk about some
issues. May I just ask a question? Just for, common dentist here. So obviously these types of efforts normally end up with some well-founded, terrific ideas, and it all comes down to execution, right? Success is whether the policies projected really are acted upon in a sustained way. And so you've concluded, it seems, that rather than using existing institutions, the Board of Regents, the Board of Trustees for UConn, the Associations for the Privates, in terms of adopting and gaining their own capacity to keep the eye on the ball on these larger important issues, you've concluded that we need to create a new body to do that. So I'm just curious as to why your thinking was that you dismissed the option of empowering or creating the capacity and task of using the existing institutions that are there, which ostensibly, because of their appointments, I mean, do have, at least theoretically, have the independence, but the trust from the political leadership which appointed the members of those bodies.
Yeah, that's a really good question, and I really urge any of you to go on and see about it today. I think the key point is what you absolutely have to do before. Okay. In other words, this is an agenda on behalf of the population. You need this population.
Ames, you also have a question. So Judy and Vagos. But I'm sorry, Dennis, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Yes, you are. I guess I'm stuck on, once you put the notion of authority over public dollars in a...
Where do you see that? Okay. Let me just elaborate on that, and I want to pick up on Dennis's point. The influence of an entity like this
I just want to give an example of the way we've done something like this and see if it's okay. So a number of years ago, because I've been around way too long, Connecticut was struggling with educational technology. And we had every sector was asking for different networks and this and that, and we were looking for a digital library, and we were looking for all these things, and we all came together, and we all crossed paths, and we all worked against each other, and the legislature sent a very clear message, which was that they funded nothing, zero. And a legislator at the time said to me, and we're not going to fund anything until you get it together. So I wasn't in this role, I was at CSU at the time. And so it was really the genesis of the Commission for Educational Technology, which is, and at the time was very engaged, less so now, but it had business, it had gubernatorial appointees, it had sector appointees, that had, you know, you name the crowd around technology. And the goal in the legislation says, these are the state goals. Now, commission, you sort of oversee this getting done. It doesn't mean you have, in fact, there's no budget authority. And so the commission then worked with the relevant, sort of set, further define the goals, determine, for example, what's the kind of network that we're going to build, and then use the business community to vet that network. And it was state-of-the-art at the time and leaping over technology and, you know, spent time around that, but then came to the legislature to get the commission to some degree, but the agencies and all of the players said, this is what we now know we need. And sort of said, we need a statewide network that connects schools, colleges, and libraries. We need a digital library that does da 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 da. Four very specific goals, everybody working in sync,
a very engaged commission that helped to oversee it and to say to the agencies what's happening. So, I mean, to, that was when I read this, how I was, I don't know if it's commission, I don't know what it is, but just, okay.
It just seems to me that this group, this independent group or whatever, is also the one that's going to be able to look at all of the various reports which are going to come from the institutions with regard to the measurement of the metrics, et cetera, and to be able to look at it and maybe suggest a follow-up combined meeting or a group. This group meets with this group or whatever it is because of some chance for some better cooperation or whatever the situation might be.
That's exactly the role. In fact, maybe so far, the actors in Connecticut are not just public operation. We just met this morning on, you know, Hartford, and a number of people engaged in Hartford who are public, private entities, coalitions, and other things working on a set of things. So it's a way to knit together a whole set of issues of efforts aimed at these goals. So it's more than just sort of a line of thought. So let me switch. I want to come back to things. I'm sorry. Dennis and I do not have a fixed answer to this. But I just want to underscore the places and the states that have in the water, sustained over a period of time, a broad commitment of business and civic leaders to these kinds of goals and ways to measure them and report on them, and then systematically bring those points to the political leadership and, above all, integrate it into the strategic finance policy thing. Those are the states that are making progress. And in fact, the one state that beginning with K that we work with most, if you look at the points in which Kentucky has not been making progress, it's when the governor has lost track of these issues, has failed to put forth a budget that in fact reflects the strategic priorities, and has been the business and civic leadership and the legislative leadership that has come back to him and said, no, where is your attention to the long-term goals? 2020. So it's not been a direct political thing. It's simply that the state actively knows that its future depends upon making step-by-step progress over the next few years. So, Dennis, the final thing I would say on this is this goal-setting business and developing metrics is the easy part. I mean, it's doing it and keeping it going. That's the hard part. I mean, if strategic problems don't lend themselves to solution in 1 or 2 years. These are things you work on for a long period of time. And these are therefore things that you have to keep at, and somebody has to worry about this. Now this is a task that somebody has to wake up every morning and say, my job is not to worry about campus X. My job is to worry about these four goals and these goals. And
add to this point. I understand. First of all, it clearly is an ideal situation you're describing, an independent entity that can do all those things. But I agree with a previous speaker. I don't know where the authority will flow from. Now, Ames and Dennis, you're saying you don't know, you don't have the answer, and some of us don't, I think all of us, none of us probably has the answer to that, but at some point we've got to come to an answer. And I'm afraid we may get locked into the idea that you're presenting on this slide, that it has to be an independent entity with all those tasks, let's say, but where will the authority flow from? And unless we can answer that question, we may, you know, may go after.
just so that people understand why we're being so insistent, many of you like to listen to this, you know, and we can't if nobody's speaking into a microphone. So thank you.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, absolutely.
I have a question and a plea. The question is, Representative Willis, is higher education part of results-based accountability?
It's interesting that you were saying that, because I was thinking about that paradigm for this. And you said I wasn't going to go there, but we've done individual programs on results-based accountability, but we do one program at a time, and they come in and, for instance, 1 year we did results-based accountability on the Bridges program at Western Connecticut State University, which is a
collaboration between the local schools, and which is very successful. And they did it on RBA for us, and there's some other ones. We've done a lot on early childhood before appropriations, but the bridges are the only ones that that come to mind when we've done this. But it seems to me, and I don't know if other states, and that's why I was thinking about asking this question, is that one of the things that we could do as a legislature or appropriations committee is every time someone comes in, as you do with RBA, you ask the same question. And then what we find, actually, Merle Harris is here. Didn't you do an RBA before a pro? Yeah, they did a chart. Well, what was interesting about that process was that then agencies, at first they weren't used to it and they didn't like it. There's some agency people here. They didn't like it, but then it seemed like it was on a roll. You know, people knew what the questions were going to be, and they were prepared to answer them. One of the frustrations I have, and why I think that's important, is one of the reasons I felt we needed to do this is for exactly this reason. Because, you know, as someone who was chair of the higher education and chair of the Appropriations Committee for Higher Education, everybody's coming in and asking money. And, you know, and it's a pilot here, give me this for that. And I'm saying, how do I make this decision? You know, how does that fit into what we're trying to accomplish? And different people are coming forward with different programs. And it made my head spin, because I'm saying this is the most off-the-wall system I've ever seen. It's just like as though people are throwing spaghetti at the wall and see what sticks. But there was no coherence to it. So that's what brought me here to why I wanted this, because I need this information. I need to be able to make decisions. My colleagues need to be made to make and not just reacting to when UConn comes in or whoever comes in. I didn't mean to pick on UConn. They are a big line item for me. To be able to make those determinations of what's the right thing that we should be investing in. So I didn't mean to go on, but thank you for asking that question.
One of the other strategies, and I like your work study because I really think it leads to permanent employment. But the other strategy that I don't see here is some sort of student loan forgiveness based on residency, because one of our major problems is a brain drain. And as much as we're trying to attract companies here, we're trying to assure them that there will be this workforce. And
the reason I don't put it on there is that there's almost no evidence that they do it. One of the problems that we found when the Western Interstate Commission for Higher Ed in particular looked at those kind of programs. And one of the things that they found was that they did it a lot for teachers in the Dakotas, for example, and say, you know, you stay in the state, teach, and we'll forgive your loan. At the time, Nevada was just buying out that loan and say, we'll pay it, we'll give you a bonus. In addition, come work in Clark County where we're opening a new school every month. And so, you know, those, you know, there's some ways probably to do it better, but that has to, you know, I think, like, frankly, that more importantly,
clinical experience, they're more likely to stay put. We know that's true in residencies and in healthcare, but I think it's also true in, for example, in some of the work study kinds of things in engineering and some other places. Students get hooked with an employer before they get a degree. They're much more likely to stick than they are if they have a loan from business arrangement that they can get bought out of. Part of that's why we emphasize the community engagement issue too, because students are engaging with community service and other things that are going to impact the impact. Okay, let me just switch this. Thank you.
this is where my plea comes in. Connecticut's one of the top three states in the country that's working on preschool to elementary school grade three alignment. And so that when we talk about systems here, I would like to make it at least pre-K, if not birth through grade 12, and not just K to 12. And you've got that in a number of places, and you have it. Okay. Connecticut has birth to five standards, which, you know, are looking at the alignment with the core standards, and so I think...
along with a whole set of things that we need to change. Some of them the university system of Georgia, but we know it's a very good one. So they we don't cost money to fix these problems.
We can do these projects.
I think Carrie had a question.
It's really more of an observation. I think we have some good news here in Connecticut in terms of fiscal policy, because some of the things that you were talking about, position control authority, appropriations, contracting and bonding, a lot of those things, more autonomy has been provided to the constituent units of higher education. So I think compared to other states, we probably have a more permissive fiscal regulatory policy.
I would say it's probably on the scale of 1 to 10, pending victory or not, 2.
2 being restrictive or permissive?
Restrictive.
We have no position control authority in the state of Connecticut. None.
Just giving an example of the context of the budget. When the budget is presented to the legislature, does that budget include the number of positions budgeted for UConn, Board of Regents?
In the aggregate, yes. But
we
don't approve any individual position.
Right. And how does that budget expect, does that budget outline the goals and the performance expectations of the system for each of those budgets?
Well, in terms of linking it to the goals, I don't think that's an area that we have program-based budgeting.
Yeah,
but.
So that let me be positive with things. I think this is a state that's made some efforts. I mean, the change was made related to UConn back, I think in the 1990s, and incrementally are examples. So I don't want to imply, and that goes back to my point, these things, Kelly, are maybe incremental. I think each administration, each legislative session may be able to make progress on 2 or 3 things. And so I don't want to imply.
No, I think there's a lot, there's a lot of flexibility that's being provided, with the autonomy legislation.
But at the same time, there are lots of states where, in essence, the state appropriates a single lump sum without any notion of line items, without any notion of positions. It just says, here is the money that this institution gets without designation as to what it is for. The mentality of the view is that basically these are state enterprises in which there is total state funding. State funding is a fraction of what's going on.
Oh, agreed. Absolutely.
And so, anyway, I guess our point is this should be an underlying theme of what we said, because I think it should be interpreted. Lots of good things going on in Connecticut, and progress is being made. So black and white descriptions of these things are probably really inaccurate, but there's progress that could be made.
Right. I mean, I think that's why the governor consolidated a lot of the line items. I mean, to each of the systems, there's a single appropriation. There's a single block grant.
Yeah, I think that's really a good idea. So I don't want to imply there's a lot
right.
of good things in
that. I mean, there's whole sets of statutes that the higher ed institutions are exempt from in terms of contracting and for bonding. So, I mean, I think, on
so
the continuum.
I just go back to
I'm very concerned that, but the fact that everybody's still sitting in the room tells me something very positive, that there's been some real thought-provoking engagement here. What I am concerned about is that I think, at least personally, we need to digest what we heard today and come back at this. I mean, I'm kind of thinking of I agree with you, there's flexibility, but, you know, where Ames is coming from is, but the answer, you know, the reward for doing well and the reward for not doing well are we can't differentiate them right now. And to me, what this group is struggling with, hopefully, is to take these goals and some of the specific measures that hopefully, you know, Dennis and Ames will bring us, and begin to codify that. And it gets all, I mean, I had to laugh. I turned to Roberta at one point in the hearing today and said, think about what the legislative hearing process might be like if every time at the higher ed committee, every legislator said, how does this further this? And it really, I mean, so forgive me, that's my personal opinion at the moment, but I think the conversation, I'm just looking at faces, really needs to happen. So I'm hopeful that that we're not, we have a lot of good discussion yet to have, I guess, is my point. It is 5 of 5. I don't know if you guys want to talk just very briefly about, I mean, you've heard reference to the fact that Dennis and Ames are meeting with colleges that were not able to attend any of the public meetings, and I think that's very refreshing. We will have people are having the opportunity to provide additional input, and I think the winter sabotaged a lot of that. So this seemed to be a lot more expedient. And hopefully next time we will have the opportunity to really dig some more. So does that do that well? All right. So with that, we'll hold off 5 till the next time too. I mean, it's because it really is, you know. Okay, so how do we get some traction in the state? You know, it's like each one tells one, but how do we bring more public awareness and public will to some of this work? So that's also the secondary conversation I think we need to have.
I think maybe just make one point. I think it goes back a little bit to Dennis's point. I think. And we can talk with you and Roberta about this, but providing an opportunity to see how the, particularly UConn and the Board of Regents and the independent sector, how they see how their work actually syncs with this would be very helpful, because they will be the points of action. And having an opportunity for a more sort of formal dialogue between that structure and this thing and saying, okay, how does it kind of fit, would really be helpful. But anyway, we need to talk with you about that in line with the plans for May and June, which we probably shouldn't do just on the fly.
Yeah. Agreed. But I'm seeing good body language, so hopefully we will have those discussions. And I mean, it really does get to Dennis's point, I think, about, you know, the actual work still, no matter what we do here, the actual work will take place the institutional and the system level. It's to what end again? So with that, no more lecturing, and I think I encourage everybody to take a look at the material. It's fascinating, good work. Our next meeting, by the way, I looked, if we are to stick with our second Tuesday of the month in May, would be the 13th, and you won't be here? Okay. Do you want to?
I'm going to be suffering
from post. Yeah. You know what? We will have a conversation and maybe perhaps give Roberta some much needed rest after session. But thank you all for your attention and really provocative questions and good materials. John, you had a last question?
A couple of us were talking before, after, and during the, or not after, because it's not after yet, but during this session about the lack of members present here, are we all members that are here, and what fraction does this represent Any idea? There's people I thought were members that I haven't, well, of course, I haven't been here either, but that aren't here today. I'll just put it that way.
We will take a look at that. Trying to find a day. I mean, we've had engaged. It's funny, the cast of characters.
I mean, do we hear from people who call in for, as you did with your surgery, and David was concerned that he was missing today. I think he's either away or wasn't feeling well. Oh, death in the family. So,
and Headley teaches, and so we have to at some point.
At some point, we need to think about, you know, we're trying to engage a faculty member that has not been able to attend because he's teaching. It's a good question, and we need to take a look at it. But we have heard from people when they're not coming, so there are more people that are engaged that are here.
Dennis and Ames, you plan to be here in May and June? Because, and if we have questions, for example, want to clarify some of the points you made today.
Absolutely. There are two ways. First of all, we can be in touch with you with questions all along. I think probably keeping Jeannie as the communication point. But we definitely are going to be engaged. We need to work out explicitly in what's going to happen in May and June. But, yes, we're going to be available.
And I would encourage people to not wait to meetings. You know, if questions arise, I think one of the things that I've enjoyed actually is some of the email correspondence that does in fact happen. I would ask that people try to keep the full commission, you know, send it through Jeannie and she can get it out to people, because I think that conversation really
helpful. Promotes the conversation. I just Judy mentioned along the theme, John, that you mentioned about how we broaden the conversation. And I think that's a really important thing. In fact, the people we've met with, we've said, listen, talking about the goals needs to be something we're doing in every aspect of what was happening. If you're members of other groups that are talking about the future, say, have you talked about these goals? To what extent can we really build a consensus around them? So that's a conversation Judy actually put on the agenda, but I think there's probably not enough time to talk about it now.
But a very good question. So. And with that, it is 5 o'clock. Let me wish everyone safe travels, and thank you for your participation today. Interesting conversation. And Mike, welcome again. Glad to have you.